It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Oh, God, that's better. Hi, it's Jeffrey. And I'm at home tonight. I just walked in the door, and I'm now cuddling up to a beautiful glass of concoction. Is it purple or suddenly the green? Suddenly the podcast got better. The more I drink, the more I like doing these shows with you guys.
A cup full of tequila makes the geeking go down. Sorry.
Jeffrey is quickly becoming the Dean Martin of B5. You notice that?
Wasn't it Oscar Wilde that said, I drink to make other people more interesting?
Or was
that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Very
and
good.
There's the whole Winston Churchill story. I may be drunk, but I'll be sober in the morning. You, madam, will still be ugly.
There you go.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. It was just a rough day at the office, kids. You've heard the epic story of my adventures to do this show all about snow.
And
we're in the final crunch of trying to edit the show into a real show that doesn't have any snow in it.
So when is this show coming out so that we can all partake of your adventures?
I'm quite confident that it will air probably a day or two before snow actually falls anywhere in North America. The next few moments, I'm just going to share a little of the hell that is my life with y'all.
Please do.
That was it.
Well, speaking of shows, I have an email that we got from someone whose handle is Star Furies. I kind of like to think this is our own little deep throat because of the kind of information this individual is relaying. This is actually was posted by JMS on his site, and this dates back to the end of October. And what he says is, we have an EFX house on board now, which was the last big step to be undertaken. It wasn't until the last day or so that we could really get into the CGI issues, which are huge on these stories. And in regard to that, the initial goal was to try and do three big stories on one DVD, so I wrote three scripts featuring Sheridan, Lockley, Galen, and Garibaldi. The stories, as noted previously, were huge, all over the map, from Inbar to Earth, Mars, the future, the distant past, as well as B5 itself. We're also going to be trying some new production technologies, again trying to stay ahead of the tech curve. And over the last few days, as we began to bring on crew and lay out the production, looking at just how complicated these mini-movies were going to be, the idea of making three of these monsters began to become a bit much for us to pull off on our first time out of the gate. So we decided to postpone one of the three to the next DVD and lengthen the other two to make up the difference. Given that the Garibaldi story was the most complicated visually and technically, that's the one that got pushed until potentially next time. And if the sales are anywhere near what WB expects, and I think they will be, there's no question that there will be more of these down the road.
Interesting.
And goes on to say that they're going to be looking at reimagining some of the visuals, looking at shows like Battlestar and the like, and bringing those tools into B5 while still maintaining the feel of the show.
Mm-hmm. You know what I want to see?
So,
I want to see. We recently did a story on Slice of Sci-Fi about James Cameron pushing the 3D thing. It would be kind of cool to see people do these all CGI special effects deep space scenes in 3D.
Yeah. They should do a smell-o-vision. How come everybody's all working on 3D, but nobody's talking about smell-o-vision?
I have followed 3D development for several years and have seen some great strides made in 3D. And I can tell you that just this past week, I was at an HD expo and saw the latest technology in 3D that doesn't require you wear glasses or do anything silly like that. And it was outstanding. It was outstanding. And each time, it's been a good standard that they use sports for each of these 3D experiences. If you watch a football game, pro football game, from the sidelines in 3D, it's like knocks you out. It's crazy. It's so terrific. And the stuff I just saw, and I wish I could tell you what the manufacturer, what the technology was, but I can, I have seen the light, and I can tell you that 3D is in our future, no doubt.
Wow.
So really what you need to do is hold off and do a 3D snow.
And they wonder why I drink.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know, are you familiar with the basic concept of what we call here in Hollywood runaway production?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where it's all running away from Hollywood?
Right.
Yeah. In light of Joe's wonderful news that we're going to see more and more B5, it's just a crying shame that we have to go to Canada to make it.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully we can do something about that someday.
And I'm not saying that's his, I want to just clarify that. I'm not pointing a finger at Joe for that. Totally understand. It is a condition of the budgets and the way it has to work.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly.
But it's a sad, sad state of affairs.
Yeah. If it means we actually get the stories, I'll stomach it for now, but I don't have to fully like it. But that's here and now, not necessarily later.
Well, it's our global village, kids, you know? No reason why Hollywood should have the monopoly on making it, right?
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll tell you what the difference is. No, wait. Okay, wait. Now you got me all politically charged because we just had an election. Okay, I'm all fired up.
Okay.
Here's what really makes a difference, Tim, is the way that for many of the skill sets in the industry, the Canadians can come here to Hollywood and work. The Hollywoodians can't go to Canada and work. It's a one-way street.
Gotcha.
So
that's not good.
That's why, you know, it's not that Canada has better CG talent than what we have here, and it's not that they have greater resources for studios or stages or any of the other things. What it is they work cheaper, and there is a greater kickback on the tax. There's a greater tax advantage to be there. And so you really are working at a significant percentage less than what you would pay here.
Mm-hmm. And also,
okay, well, we get that. That's the business model, and I understand why that happens. However, wouldn't it be outstanding if some of those guys who were the original animators of B5 3D models, that they understand, they know how that geometry works, and they know how to speak Joe's language, and they could just be available to go up, and even if you had to go work in Canada, but that those, the talent from here, you know, could go up there. Whether it was one of our wardrobe people to make Sheridan's new costume, or the makeup people that did Londo hair, whatever, you know, there can't be any, we're not allowed to go there and work.
Well, that's
unless, of course, you are a Canadian citizen,
yeah,
which means you're already, you know, double dipping.
Hmm.
You're already down here. So anyway, okay, now you got me off that pedestal. I'm ready to go.
Okay.
Well, hopefully we can see a resolution to that sometime. I hope so.
I know. We should get all the actors and production people, get them all together, put green cloth and purple cloth into a big barrel.
Well, yes. He never lets that go, does he?
Nope.
I think it's a marvelous solution to any problem.
It is. It is a marvelous solution, one I highly recommend, and it's kind of appropriate since that is tonight's topic, the episode Geometry of Shadows. And we will jump right into that episode discussion right after this.
Let our frequencies carry you away. Survive horrors unimagined and discover wonders unseen. Encounter new worlds, rocket through the depths of space, and delve into realities that exist in dark mirrors of our own. On Variant Frequencies, we cross genres and boundaries to bring listeners a completely different audio experience. Featuring Parsec Award-winning fiction, we deliver a new short story every month and present serialized novels that test the limits of podcast fiction. Find us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Subscribe today.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom. This is Deep Geeking.
Okay, where'd that come from?
Yarsto's sneaky.
I think someone's been having a little fun while I've been gone, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, tonight's Deep Geeking episode is about...
I need the Deep Geeking by itself so I can drop that in every time that you say that. I'll do that later.
No.
Okay, I have not watched this episode, so I'm leaving.
Okay.
Enjoy.
Bye. Yes, I've done a beautiful, beautiful thing. He has been listening to our geeking for so long now. He said, okay, I'm going to sit. Give me the Babylon 5 DVDs. I want to see what I've been missing. So he sat and watched season one in what, 7 days?
One day.
You watched them all in one day?
One day. Seven.
Wow.
On Sunday.
Wow.
I started at
7, I think it was like about 7:45 in the morning, and I was done at midnight.
That's impressive.
Yep.
That is impressive.
I had no other time. It's the only time I've got. Between all the shows that are out there, that's what I have.
Yeah. Now, see, I've only done that with season three, but I applaud you, sir. And as soon as I got here today, he's like, give me season two. I'm like, we're not done with season two yet. You can't have it yet. He's looking
Although
at me
Lori
like,
will probably kill me because I sat on the couch all day Sunday watching B5.
You can probably rent season one at Disc at a Time on Netflix.
Oh, I'm sure.
So you don't have to wait
have
for
Have you tried
me.
Checking your local library? I know our library has the five seasons of Babylon 5, and I would wager that they don't ever quite see the shelf. I think they're almost always in circulation.
Yeah.
Okay, well, enough about
anyway.
Me. Okay. You guys need to geek.
Cool. So yes, tonight's episode is what I consider to be the first major domino, the first big one that knocks down about five other rows of dominoes later on. Geometry of Shadows, which also won awards, many awards. How many awards did it win?
Just Geometry of Shadows? I don't think it won anything. The Coming of Shadows won the Hugo.
Was it nominated? I'm going to have to go look that up.
Yeah, I don't think so. I know in the first year of Babylon 5, one of the reasons they didn't win the Hugo is because they had like five episodes up for nominations. And people were nominating their favorite individual episode out of that. And JMS sent out the word on the internet basically saying, people, please, let's all rally behind one show, one episode, so we can win the Hugo. Because if you took the total total tally of votes for Babylon 5, it would have won the Hugo. The problem was that it was spread across five different nominations or something like that.
I'm actually at any rate looking.
Okay.
Geometry of Shadows was... Oh, they have Emmy nominations here. That's what I'm looking at.
That's right. That's right.
They have Emmy nominations. They won an Emmy for makeup for Parliament of Dreams. They were nominated for cinematography and hairstyling for Geometry of Shadows.
There we go.
I knew there were some awards in there somewhere, because second season is when that stuff started just piling up.
Right. And speaking of hairstyling, you notice, especially in light of our conversation with Peter Jurasik, the episode opens with Veer combing out Wanda's
hair. Yeah.
And it's starting to look nicer.
Yes. Having your entourage taking care of your hair, you know you've stepped up a level in the royal court, so to speak.
And the next thing you know about stepping up in the royal court is that Lord Rifa is there, and he's talking with Londo about the attack on the Narn base in Quadrant 37. And everybody wants to know how he did it. And, of course, Londo is very reluctant to let the cat out of the bag, as it were, because it's his
dark little secret.
Right to the top. Yes, right. That's exactly. And Rifa is quite content to let it be a secret for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And he's obviously there at a fact-finding role, trying to suss out Londo's feelings about the current emperor and the status of succession in the Centauri Republic, and where Londo's loyalties truly lie.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting that Rifa played on one of Londo's insecurities. He didn't so much care in the long run who knew in the royal court that he was responsible. He was terrified of Jakar and the Narns finding out that he was personally responsible for giving the go-ahead for that order.
Right.
And somehow Rifa was like, well, as long as the Narns don't know it was you, we can work together.
Right. Yeah, and he also plays on Londo's patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the words that Rifa is using is about, you know, restoring the glory of the Republic. The Emperor is old and weak, and his nephew is seen as a fool, although we'll find out more about him later.
Oh, yeah.
But having said that, so he's basically, Rifa is trying to gather his forces. He knows that Londo is obviously has some power behind him and is trying to rope him into his own scheme.
Mm. And I always wondered. I never saw Londo as someone who was dissatisfied with the current monarch, the current emperor. But I wonder if maybe he was quicker to join Rifa's cause because he still felt that being relegated to ambassador of B5 as being in exile, even though it put him in position to gain more power than he ever would have if he had stayed home.
Yeah, there's a moment there when, in so many words, Rifa extends his hand to Londo, to basically join forces, and there's this kind of awkward moment where it's like Londo is gathering up the courage to take that step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been, I don't want to say a timid character, but like you said, he's been relegated to, you know, the backwaters, if you will. You know, as we find out later on, Londo was given the ambassadorship to Babylon 5 because nobody else wanted it. And so he's got that sort of inertia there, and he has to almost physically force himself to take that step, but he does it, you know, and he takes that next step further down the dark path. And it's significant. Like you say, this is starting and setting up a domino that's going to start playing out as the second year goes on.
Mm-hmm. And after that little introduction to Lord Rifa, we have our first sight of Technomages.
Do you want the bad news now?
Sure.
Until Galen came along, I thought the make Technomages was a dumb idea.
Really?
I think I'm one of maybe two people on the planet, and I think that other person is underwater in Atlantis somewhere. Yeah. You want to hear it all now?
Sure, because I mean, literally, I see Technomages as an inevitable evolution.
Sure.
Of our obsession with technology and the ingenuity of geeks combined. I mean,
right.
Think about how many technological body mods there are out there. The one guy talking about manipulating or sensing electrical fields by implanting micro magnets in your fingertips. Dude.
Oh, cool.
There are people who would do that in half a heartbeat. They just could never get an MRI the rest of their lives.
Well, right, there you go. Oh, they'll be able to give themselves their own MRI. Here's kind of the long and the short of it, and I admit that it's kind of personal taste.
Okay.
I am not really a fantasy fan. I like my rockets, robots, and ray guns over my sword and sorcery. All right?
And I'm pretty much the opposite, so...
Okay, and that's interesting. That's what I find. There's a lot of people who love the Technomages are also big fantasy fans. And one of the things that I loved about Babylon 5 was how science fiction-y it was. You know, Star Trek is a great show, but it really only uses the science fiction genre as a way to tell its morality tales, okay? Babylon 5 is very much about the science fiction, and we've touched on it with the way the Star Furies move and the fact that Earth Force ships are these big clumsy things that have to use rotating sections to generate artificial gravity. And so, you know, I could go on. But suffice it to say, it's very much a thing of the future. The Technomages, to me, smacked of going back to the past. And maybe if he had called them something else, I would have been better with it. I don't know. And like I said, Galen in Crusade, I thought, was the right portrayal of that technology. I guess the thing is, it was played too much like magic in Babylon 5. For my taste. And in Crusade, it was basically just super advanced technology, and I could deal with that. And yes, I know Clark's law, and sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And yes, there's the scene in the Zocalo where Elric is walking along with Sheridan,
mm-hmm.
and they have actually a good conversation. I've come to appreciate that scene for what he's saying in terms of, you know, Babylon 5 might seem like magic to, you know, somebody from, you know, 200,000 years ago, and Elric's response is, well, who's to say it's not now? And there's the other thing, and here's another thing. I could not ever finish Stormbringer, the first Elric novel.
Okay.
I just found it all just extremely dull and boring and hard to read. And here comes this character, and his name is Elric. It's like, if you could not pull out a worse name for a character. So it's pushing, I mean, from the word go, it's pushing all the wrong buttons for me. Okay, so.
So that said.
Having said that. And then there's a couple other things in there that I think were kind of kludgy. For all their power that they supposedly have, all we really see are parlor tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, so that it's like, you're not really showing me anything, any real power as such. Okay. Rolando sees them coming on board the station. He recognizes them. Oh, technomages and humans by the looks of them. So there's the implication that they could be other races. And he mentions that, you know, that they obviously must have been Centauri, but we never see anything but humans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when he goes, and as far as I can tell, the only there's nothing that really says technomage. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's not like weird flowing capes as really as they're dressed. They're not any weirder than anybody else that ever showed up on the station. So when Londo is looking for the image of him clasping hands with Elric as a symbol for support back home, who's to say they wouldn't just say, in essence, he just got some guy in a suit? You know? Why would a human technomage carry greater weight than, say, a Centauri technomage?
Because it's a technomage, period. My impression was always, from the beginning, that they were using technology, advanced technology, to make it seem like they could do magic. It was never about power. It was always about knowledge. I didn't see them as being mages in the fact that, oh, they're going to like toss out a fireball and save a planet from an asteroid. No. It was always about knowledge, self-knowledge, along with the technical knowledge to be able to transcend yourself while still in your physical form. To change, to be able to do something because the technology was there and you had the dedication to go through the training and the learning of these, what I'm assuming are secret techniques and technologies that they are guarding for when whoever, you know, their races are ready for them, more so to speak. And Elric specifically says, we see a great darkness coming, we're getting the hell out of Dodge. And my thought from what I saw later, from what we now know later,
right. All
the human technomages started getting out of town after Clark came to power. They knew that Clark was shadow touched and wanted to get away from that.
Okay, right. I hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on an intellectual level, I accept what you're saying. But again, at an emotional level,
you're still at the point where you were when you first saw it, and you went, "Oh man, is this a cheap trick?"
right. having watched it for the podcast, I appreciate better what Straczynski was writing and trying to get across. But again, it just, for me personally, it just never quite comes together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, Michael Ansara, who played Elric, did a marvelous job.
He
drips venom when, you know, he's talking with Veer and says, do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they're subtle and quick to anger.
I have been corrupted by ancient, you know, computer geek jokes, because every time I hear that line or read that line, my mind automatically replaces it with, for you are crunchy and good with ketchup.
Yeah, right. <that's,
laughs> I'm sorry. It's just my brain automatically puts that one in there. I'm like, oh, man.
Right. And at the very end, when the technomages are leaving, and Elric is talking with Londo, and he's you know, and I like this. This was subtle, where he's talking with him and says, you know, I see a great darkness on you, and I could kill you, but somebody's going to take your place, so there's no change. I could try to warn you, but you won't listen, so there's no change. So I do the only thing I can do, which is to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the classic line, I see a great hand reaching out from the stars.
And billions of people are calling your name.
My followers?
No, your victims.
Oh, chilling.
Oh, that was one of the first moments where I sat up and went, whoa. I mean, literally, that's to lay that on someone and say, no, you're victims. And to watch him go, whoa, I don't know. There's a better word out there than whoa, but when I first saw it, there wasn't. So.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's one of those. It's perfectly delivered, perfectly written, and carries so much meaning and menace and the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fantastic.
And I have to have a secret little glee about the Londo's punishment, the magical torment the technical torment in his quarters. The Narn opera part was kind of funny, but watching Data on his screen just being chomped away, I really have to wonder if during the writing of this episode, or just a short time before the writing of this episode, did JMS suffer a catastrophic computer crash, infection, just something that would drive a person to insanity because their computer did something that it shouldn't really do. And he decided to vent by putting that in the up. That was just funny. Just, you know, watching the Data go away. You now own 500,000 shares of Fireflies Incorporated. And the spoof arm thing was funny.
Yes, right.
Just
right.
having random computer glitches happen like that.
Yeah.
As revenge.
Right. Yeah. That's good hacker stuff right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
So I just wonder, was he inspired by a real life event, or was that just his way of, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, but I would not be surprised.
Because yeah. I have a little anecdote I remember reading when he was in season 3, and I'll relay it then. Everybody probably knows it, but I fell out of my chair laughing when I first read it. So, and now, huh?
I can't wait.
I'll tell you later.
All right, fine.
And the best part of this episode.
Yes. Now this was the thing that for me completely negates any bad taste in my mouth that I have with Technovages. Or anything like that.
Purple.
Is the whole green. It is classic. You get a little character advancement. Ivanova is promoted to the rank of commander.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the little bit, you know, the scene between her and Sheridan, and he's, you know, he's trying to be all subtle and underhanded, but you can tell it's, you know, it's just kind of a, you know, he's taking a little bit of glee. You know, would you like some orange juice, freshly squeezed, Commander? And she's like, what? And, you know, and it makes sense in terms of the story. She deserves a promotion. And he says he pushed the paperwork through as soon as he got in. And here's your first job. You know, if you can handle these incidences, like these Drazis getting to fight for no apparent reason, frees me up to do, you know, bigger, more strategic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Well, you know, and of course, as we find out, the Drazi all over the galaxy are going through this cyclical ritual of, especially coming out of our own American political rituals,
choosing
where the Drazi
dominant political structure for the next 5 years by getting into fistfights with the opposing group. Now, I think that would tend to make things a little interesting.
Well,
I would like to see actual congressional death matches. I think that's something we need.
Yeah, and get rid of party affiliation. Just put, you know, like the Drazi did, equal number of green and purple ribbons in a barrel. You draw them, and that's your side.
And then you wait your turn to jump in the ring, and you go against somebody else, you know, somebody else random from the other color, and just blah, 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 blah. And whoever has the most people left standing at the end, they kind of control things for the next 4 years. And
Yeah. Right. You know, get rid of all the mudslinging. Just let them go ahead and duke it out.
Mm-hmm.
I love how Ivanova at the beginning is trying to be Miss Diplomat, but
mm-hmm.
she can't be. It's just not her temperament because she starts getting sarcastic on him early on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not helping anything. And then when she pulls the ribbon off the one and puts it on the other, it's like automatically there's this imbalance and the one side sees its opening. Wait, there's more of us than them. Get them. And that's, of course, where they have written in the broken foot for Ivanova.
Yes. And I thought it was interesting because you actually see her reluctance, and she said, like, you want me to do diplomacy? What?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And she's all geeked to become a commander. And then looks at the Drazi on the monitor that are in lockup for having the fight in the Zocalo, and her face just falls. You know, and you know, as the episode goes on, she's very much about being tenacious and solving it. You know, she doesn't want to give up and say this is not anything she can handle, even though she's clearly
mm-hmm.
out of her element. you know, but you just can't quite find the handle to solve it.
I thought it was an interesting parallel. I don't know if it's in there on purpose or not, but her figuring out what to do with the Drazi was kind of like, you know, she's sitting there when she's in the med lab looking around going, now if I can only just figure out how to get off this table. You see her starting to go, okay, I'm stuck, but I have to move forward. How do I do that? And I could be putting too much, you know, credit there. It just happened to be a parallel. Or I just happened to see it as a parallel because it hit me that way.
Sure.
When I watched it. Or I just could be seeing too much. But I just thought it was, well, I thought it was a parallel. I did.
Yeah, I mean, we could get into the whole discussion about what you see in art is half of what you bring with you. But having said that, it's valid. I don't find it unusual or pushing it too much. What I liked is how the Drazi situation at first starts off as it's almost played for laughs. Oh, look at these wacky aliens, blue, you're purple, green. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, you know, that's silly. Until they come into place and find them all dead.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you realize, you know, they're playing this for keeps. And the stakes have suddenly just ratcheted up.
Yeah,
I thought that was.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because it didn't seem like there had been a problem with this before. They would just like beat each other up until things get out of hand, and then all of a sudden, there was just message. Things escalated on the homeworld. You're like, oh no,
right. They're
going to escalate here too. And sure enough, dead bodies on the floor.
Yeah, now that's something that's interesting that, and I haven't really gone looking for any literature to find out, but the implications, since this seems to be a new thing, at least for the humans anyways, and I'm guessing for a number of people, because you would have thought somebody would have come and said, oh yeah, the Drazi do this, just, you know, sweat it out, don't get involved. It makes me think that the Drazi are relatively new on the galactic scene.
I wouldn't say relatively new. I'd say new in dealing with humans. And it's just one of those things. Other aliens have been dealing with Drazi for hundreds of years. They're used to it. It wouldn't even dawn on them to mention, oh, by the way, every 5 years the Drazi do this. You might want to watch your furniture. You know?
Right. Okay. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair. Now, I liked the Drazi capturing Ivanova.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're playing the game. They know that Commander Ivanova wants to find a peaceful solution, so they use that as bait to bring her down to the to their stronghold. They're the green ones, if I remember right.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. It's been a week or so since I've seen it. So the green ones have her and say, you know what, this is what you're going to do. You're going to tell all the purple ones to show up down in this section. Tell them what we want to talk peace. It's like, okay. And then what you'll do is you'll open up the space doors. That'll take care of the problem once and for all.
There'll be peace on the station. You'll be happy. We'll be happy. Wait a minute.
Now I think we should take a step back and mention the fact that Garibaldi is having a crisis of faith.
Yes.
Because that plays into the solution to the Drazi problem. He is out of med lab, healing up, but still not back to his normal self. And he's wondering, you know, he's having doubts as to whether or not he can still do his job since he was shot in the back by his own man and, you know, what good is he to anybody if he can't figure something out going on right under his nose?
Mm-hmm. And that's really shaken him up because it was his second in command who did it. And
right. The
guy was right there the whole entire time and he never saw it. And he thinks he should have.
Right. Exactly. And that, you know, number one, it plays into things we know about Garibaldi where he's had a history of screwing up on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And while on an objective level, he could be forgiven for not having seen this. You know, emotionally for him, it is yet another sign that he's going to fall apart again. You know, so he's worried about that.
He's basically being too hard on himself because he thinks he should be perfect.
Right. Right. But, however, it does come into play later on. Mm-hmm. To Lou Welsh, who says that they got a message from Commander Ivanova that the Drazi are all meeting at a particular place, and Garibaldi goes, oh, that's nice, she's promoted to commander. And then he goes, wait a minute, did you talk to her? No, we just got a message. He's like, but you didn't talk to her, did you? And that, of course, gets the Garibaldi we know and love back in action because he knows something's up because it's different than what normally happens with Ivanova.
Right. Technically, his spider sense went up. He knows Ivanova well enough to know that she wouldn't do that. And the investigator in him is curious. It's like, okay, what would happen that would either A, make her do that, or B, get her out of the way so somebody could do that in impersonating her? And he went into that old hard-boiled PI mode and rescued the commander.
Yep.
I love that.
Yeah, with a little bit of
door-to-door salesman
stuff there too. Yes. Handy dandy Acme helper.
Yes. Anybody in here who needs help, just sing out.
And I'll help.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. That was very well written.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
stomps on the Drazi's foot, Garibaldi!
Yeah. And I must comment that Ivanova's solution to the purple-green problem was unintended, unique, and completely typical for what we know goes on in the station.
Right. Yes. Yes. And, you know, there's one thing that I loved in the final scene where she marches out with
Well, hang on, back up. We have to say that she in anger reaches out and grabs Green Leader's sash.
Right. Well, see here's the thing. I was going to take a step back before that.
Okay.
There's the dialogue where they talk about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
She says, we're going to lock you up for a cycle, and then it'll all be over, and things will be back to normal. And they all start chuckling. And it's like, what? And you think that, you know, there's a couple things that go on here where there's some subtle power plays, who's on top of whom. And the humans, you know, Garibaldi and Ivanova think they got him. Well, we'll hold you for a cycle, everything will be fine. And they start laughing. It's like, what's so funny? Oh, Drazi's cycle is a year, not a week. You're going to keep us all in lockup for a year? And then Ivanova, you know, has her outburst. It's like, this makes no sense. You guys are fighting over a piece of cloth. And the Drazi said, well, you do the same, don't you? And usually in almost as a cliche in science fiction, it stops there because it's supposed to make you as the viewer think, oh, wow, I'm going to question my own thinking about what it means to have a flag and so forth, so on.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, it is just a piece of cloth, except Straczynski takes it one step further. And Ivana says, no, it's not the same. Our flags have meaning. They're symbols that stand for something. Your green and purple sashes are simply arbitrary. It's like, you know what? What a great comeback.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, that's emblematic of the subtlety and detail that Babylon 5 had in its writing. That it presented all sides. You know, I mean, the Drazi, in a sense, are right. Yeah, you know, how are the sashes any different than the Earth Force flag or you know, Earth Alliance flag or American flag or whatever? And in one level, there is no difference, but yet on a very significant level, there is a very, very important difference. And Ivanova says that, and that's just great. And then at that point, she reaches out and grabs the sash. And I love how they all snap to attention with this real nervous look on their faces.
And she's still ranting. She's still ranting about it, and they're standing at perfect attention. And she looks. She finally realizes that they're not saying anything. They are just standing there. She goes, what?
Right. Yeah, exactly. He who has green sash is green. He was green leader sash is green leader, leader of all greens.
So you're green leader. What?
But I'm not Drazi. Well, you know, the rules didn't say anything about aliens. And as goofy as it was, it works really well.
I mean, just
rule change caught up in committee.
Yeah, that whole line. He's like, well, doesn't take into account aliens. Rules change right. Caught up in committee. Sorry.
I know, there's almost an embarrassment, too, when he says it. It's like, it's classic. And then the final line, which goes off our crutches. Come with me. We're going down to the quartermasters and getting dying. It's going to all look gorgeous and purple.
Yes. And I always wondered if that was maybe an homage to the "but in purple, I'm stunning."
Yes. Yes, I think it is.
Yeah. And
it's classic.
We had someone in the chat room actually asked why green and purple? And the response from someone else in the chat room was, it was mentioned in the script books.
I've got that one, but I can't remember what it says specifically about green and purple.
I don't know.
I don't have it handy, so I can't really.
I don't know. I would like to find out why particularly green and purple. I mean, we know purple because purple is just stunning. But why green?
Because classic. That's one of those episodes. It's always a fan favorite. It's always funny. Every time I see it, it still makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. It's like one of those things that just gets funnier the more you watch it.
Yeah, and watching it again after having heard Claudia relay her story about breaking her foot before filming it was just
right
funnier. I don't know, for me anyway.
No, I agree. And what's interesting is most shows, when something like that happens to the star, they either rewrite the scripts or they try to hide the fact that this person has got an injury or is pregnant or whatever, you know? I love it, especially when actresses are pregnant. And it's like they hide them behind plants and, you know, they sit on the sofa and grab a bunch of pillows and put on their lap. You know, it's like, this was very much, she hurt her foot. We'll work it into the script.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. You know, the fight in the council chambers where she gets injured.
Hurt.
Right.
Is the reason
it all works.
We're the crutches. So, and we see that later too, but we'll get to that. Other injuries worked into the storyline. So
that's fun. I love Geometry of Shadows for the Drazi piece, and of course Garibaldi decides to come back on the Force.
Yep.
And
we're happily ever after, sort of.
Right.
We can take a breath for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. And it's interesting is other than the scene with Elric and Sheridan and the Zocalo, this really is, the focus is elsewhere. You know, the first two episodes of the new season two, are very Sheridan heavy. You know, we got a new commander, a new character, we want to get to know him, that's fine. And then this one, he just kind of steps back, and it works very nice.
Okay. Well, that will conclude our little discussion of Geometry of Shadows, and we'll be right back with some listener feedback right after this.
Slice of sci-fi for people who watch TV and go to the movies. You know, normal people.
SliceOfSciFi.com.
I love that episode. Don't you?
It's fantastic. You guys are a crack up.
But you love us, right?
Well, I worry about you, and I'm thinking about calling your mothers, because it's really getting serious.
Well,
you wouldn't be telling my mother anything she doesn't already know.
Yeah, mine either. We have
I would just
make
up. I thought
it was actually pretty cool.
1, 2, 3, 4. I'm looking at the screen here. We have 5 voicemails. How many emails do we have?
I have one.
One email. Now, the trick is, can we get through this in enough time to make Michael happy?
No.
No.
It'll never happen, but give it a shot.
Okay.
Well, why don't we take the voicemails in chronological order? Let's go from the oldest to the newest.
I have no idea which one to which on this screen here.
Huh?
Okay. Just
they're in order. They're not in order. They're just here.
Play the first one.
Oh, okay.
This is Jasto from the Netherlands with my first actual Babylon 5 haiku. Babylonian, ancient diplomacies, Tang, B5's legacy.
That was more of a high rather than a haiku, right? That was just.
I think it had enough beats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we're starting to get a few of those haikus. Sci-fi coups are actually very popular.
Did you say sci-fi coups?
I kid you not. Revolution SF Magazine has a whole section dedicated to sci-fi coups.
That's pretty cool. Of course, there's you know, actual real-life haiku masters just ripping up their calligraphy brushes going, oh my God, he's mad.
Yeah, exactly.
You think I'm kidding. I will go find some for you. No,
I don't think you're kidding at all. That's why I'm saying it.
Now, what I'm worried about is that we're going to have a battle between, all right, the haikus will be wearing purple. The people doing limericks will be wearing green.
Oh, we don't have any limericks. Some of these are
we're gonna get limericks. I'm looking at the chat room. We're gonna get
dirty
limericks.
Babylon 5 limericks.
I don't know if they'll be dirty or not, but we're gonna get limericks. Limericks will be green. Haikus will be purple. Okay, next voicemail.
Hey, Summer, Tim, Jeff, and Mike there in the background. This is John from the Dispatches from Tuzanor podcast. I just wanted to weigh in on this whole Babylon 5 versus Battlestar Galactica debate. First off, I do agree that Babylon 5 is a bit easier to rewatch than Battlestar Galactica, that you get more out of rewatching Babylon 5. And I think that it has a lot to do with structure. I think that JMS had structure and had a plan in place before he even started the first season of Babylon 5, and I think that's the big difference. JMS has this whole character and plot arc set that he went through, and you can go back and rewatch the shows once you understand what the destination is, and you can watch the journey unfold from the beginning to the end. With Battlestar Galactica, well, the series is still running, so it's hard to really know what the end might be. But at the same time, it's also abundantly clear that Ron Moore and company, they're making it up as they go along. They may have some certain themes and some ideas in store, but as Ron Moore has admitted in the past, if someone else comes up with a better idea, a better direction in the writer's room, he'll take that rather than stick to a plan that he may feel is inferior. Whatever the case may be, JMS had a great deal of control over where the story was going on Babylon 5. Ron Moore is more open to suggestions, is more open to changes, and so there's not going to be that same level of layering and foreshadowing and planning put into it. So I think that's why it's not as rewatchable, as you say, because you really are not invited to go back and look at how it was all built up from the very beginning. Well, that's about it. I've rambled on for long enough. Thank you, and I am still enjoying the podcast. Keep up the good work.
Aww. So basically, the Cylons have a plan, but Ron Moore doesn't.
Okay.
This would be a good point for me to read this email that I have here.
Okay.
Because I have to eat a little bit of crow, as it were. This comes from Hillary Giffen. Hillary writes, "Hi Tim, Summer, and Jeff. I've been a B5 fan since season 2 when I finally succumbed to peer pressure to check out this fabulous series. The variety you present on the podcast with the interviews and episode analysis is exceptional. I think it's especially fantastic that you interview the production people as well to give you a full view of the process of making a show. I look forward to the podcast every week. Now, I do have one request. Tim, stop baiting Summer with Battlestar Galactic emails, and Summer, please stop rising to the bait. We all know it's a good show, but it's so different from B5, it's like comparing apples and honey buns. There are plenty of podcast that I can go to for discussion of Galactica, but only one place I can go for B5. Please, let's keep it about Babylon 5. Now, I wrote back to Hillary and said, well, you know what, sometimes these things kind of take on a life of their own, but they're on a cycle, and I think we're pretty much past mm-hmm. the Babylon 5 Battlestar Galactica comparison. Mm-hmm. And then I forgot we had that voicemail there. So,
and I think we're it started out from a good place in our hearts, because we know, really, that without Babylon 5's success at kicking open the doors for different science fiction storytelling, would Ron Moore have been able to do Battlestar Galactica now the way he's doing it? I don't think so.
Right, I agree.
So,
I agree. Shoulders of giants, as Einstein said, if I have achieved so much, it is because I've stood on the shoulders of giants.
Cool.
Excuse me.
Yep.
And I think that's very much the case here. Okay, right. So there we are. We will put that to bed. Roll the next voicemail.
This is Jarsto from the Netherlands and of the Dutch Channel podcast with an early response to episode 41. First of all, congratulations to Mike for becoming a Babylon 5 fan. The physics really are more realistic than pretty much anything else out there. One good case in point from the first season, which you may or may not have seen yet, is in A Voice in the Wilderness, where you will actually see the captain of the Hyperion is trapped in because the Hyperion, without any rotating sections, lacks internal gravity. With the whole boys' night theme, I'm a bit surprised no one mentioned Ivanova showing up for work naked dream. And to add some balance to that theme, I'd just like to point out that Sheridan has a shower scene toward the end of season 2. Finally, a note on Jeffrey's role on the show. Not only does he keep your feet firmly on the ground between the deep geeking, he also keeps your feet firmly in the gutter. Mike and Tim had managed to move from naked girls to strong female characters and character development in Babylon 5. And Jeffrey had to bring things back down again by talking about casting sessions and the hotties he'd seen.
Well, yeah, and so
although I will say this, I was very impressed with how geeky Jeff could get when we were responding to the voicemail about Sheridan and Sinclair and their different types of command styles, and Jeffrey went on this whole Tim Worthy rant of how, you know, one is an administrator and the other is an action guy and the whole nine yards.
I was impressed too. I figured it would be me and Jeff sitting over there listening to Tim rant on about geeky stuff, and boy, you know, Jeff jumped right in there. That's another thing that kind of spurred me on to start watching these shows. It's like, damn, I'm not a big enough geek yet.
Wow.
Jeff, you hadn't had as much alcohol that night, I think.
No, that whole geek thing that happened was actually the painful process of sobriety creeping through. Bear with me, folks. I'll try to keep it to a minimum.
Okay, let's hit the next one.
Hi, this is Iron Eagle again. I apologize for the topic of this voicemail, but even though it's not directly B5 related, it's a direct response to one of your shows. During the live stream for episode 41, at least I think it will end up as 41, Captain Janeway was mentioned as one of the first non-female cliché roles in the Star Trek universe. You're kidding me, right? There is this new shiny spaceship with a woman in command docked to DS9. And just a few minutes after the ship leaves the station, there are scratches all over the hull. Much stuff is broken, and Janeway has no idea where she is. No, if that's not a typical woman cliché, I don't know what is.
Oh.
Anyway, don't be mad at me, girls. I'm just quoting a TV ad for Voyager, which was shown here in Germany.
Really?
Or to say it with Delenn's words, I'm your friend. In peace. This is Iron Eagle signing off. And I don't care if it's evil or not, because in the end, we are all kosh.
I hate long goodbyes, but that was poignant for the episode. It would be fun. That fit right into where we went. Did you get to hear our show last week, Summer, when you were gone?
I tuned in for some of it. I was actually listening to some of it while I was packing, since my plane left real early Thursday morning.
Well, I think you'd be proud. I think we all behave very nicely in the sandbox, and it worked out well. It should be it should give you the confidence that you can leave home. Your house will still be standing when we get back.
I think you'll just shake your head.
Well, I listening to the live feed from last week is one of the things I plan to do soon. So we have one more voice.
One quick one.
One more. Okay.
This is Jarsto from the Netherlands. One of Jeffrey's old statements popped into my head, and instantly, another Babylon podcast haiku was born. Old Vorlon proverb. Chicks dig the encounter suit. So practice your glide. I'm not sure why, but Vorlons make for good haiku writing material, it seems.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's a great say. I tell you what, I hope he never stops listening, because I think our audience will actually reduce by 50%.
You know, we need a Jarsto bumper. Jarsto Radio, man.
I know. Yarstow. I know. He's slowly working his way in here.
Yeah. That's a good one.
That was a good one.
It's profound. Practice your glide.
Yeah, we're gonna have to print that one and frame it and send it to Jeff.
Oh boy.
Well, that's it for.
No. You're done.
Yeah, no. That's it for our listener feedback. But I do have one shameless bit of begging to do. Shameless begging. Everyone knows already that. I've contributed an essay to the Battlestar Galactica collection, So Say We All, and I have been trying literally for a year to get the Ben Bella folks to do one on Babylon 5. And up until right before Dragon Con, when I told them about the Lost Tales, it was always, oh, Babylon 5 was too long ago, there aren't enough people who remember it. I'm like, whoa, hang on a second. Are you even aware of how rabid these fans are and how much they crave new B5 stuff? And she's like, no, tell me. Wait a minute. I can get you that data. So at Dragon Con, I told the one rep that was there about the Lost Tales, and she was like, wow, that's pretty good. And I wish I could have dragged her with me to the Babylon 5 panel that was at Dragon Con. And she couldn't leave at the time. So what I am here to do, and she has encouraged me to do this, I want you to either post on the Babylon Podcast website, babylonpodcast.com, or over at the forums, the Babylon Podcast forums over at cultofsummer.com, I want you to post whether or not you would buy a Ben Bella Books Smart Pop collection for Babylon 5. For anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about, go to smartpopbooks.com. Take a look at what they've done there. I mean, their very first Smart Pop collection was on The Matrix, Taking the Red Pill. And they've done a good 20, 25 books since then, covering Farscape, Stargate, Superman, Dick Tracy, Harry Potter, the Philip Pullman Dark Materials series, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe series. They've got one on Star Trek that just came out.
I was going to say, I picked up the one on Star Trek, and being a longtime Trek fan, I didn't buy it. I was without cash at the time, but leafed through it, and I, you know, picked it up in the bookstore. And I did it with trepidation because, you know, how many times can we tell the same story?
Mm-hmm.
And I was electrified at the freshness of the material in there.
Yeah, and the Star Wars on Trial one that has David Brin versus Matt Stover, editing the defense and the prosecution is brilliant.
The one
that electrified me, the Firefly one, the Serenity one, is good. The one they did on Buffy is good. The one they did on Angel is brilliant. So we need to let them know that Babylon 5 fans will buy a collection on Babylon 5 if they decide to do one. So I'm pushing for them to say, yes, we're going to put a Babylon 5 one on our schedule. So email me, post on the website. I'm going to collect all this feedback, and I'm just going to say, hey, Leah, right here. Lots of people would buy this book. So get that feedback to me. Get that feedback to Tim. All of us will collect it. And hopefully sometime next year we'll have a B5 collection to talk about. So that's my shameless pimping for the day.
And go by So Say We All.
Yes, go by So Say We All, and if I see you at a con, I'll even sign it. But that will do it for this week's Babylon podcast. If you want to submit your own haiku, limerick, or voicemail, you can contact us at babylonpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the great limericks came upon us all.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the haiku.